Chapter 22. The next morning we check out of the hotel, feeling refreshed, say goodbye to the DeWeeses, and head north on the open road out of Bozeman. The DeWeeses wanted us to stay, but a peculiar itching to move west and get on with my thoughts has taken over. I want to talk today about a person whom Phaedrus never heard of, but whose writings I've studied quite extensively in preparation for this Chautauqua. Unlike Phaedrus, this man was an international celebrity at 35, a living legend at 58, whom Bertrand Russell has described as, by general agreement, the most eminent scientific man of his generation. He was an astronomer, a physicist, a mathematician, and philosopher all in one. His name was Jules-Henri Poincaré. It always seemed incredible to me, and still does, I guess, that Phaedrus should have traveled along a line of thought that had never been traveled before. Someone somewhere must have thought of all this before, and Phaedrus was such a poor scholar, it would have been just like him to have duplicated the commonplaces of some famous system of philosophy he hadn't taken the trouble to look into. So I spent more than a year reading the very long and sometimes very tedious history of philosophy in a search for duplicate ideas. It was a fascinating way to read the history of philosophy, however, and a thing occurred of which I still don't know quite what to make. Philosophical systems that are supposed to be greatly opposed to one another, both seem to be saying something very close to what Phaedrus thought, with minor variations. Time after time I thought I'd found whom he was duplicating, but each time, because of what appeared to be some slight differences, he took a greatly different direction. Hegel, for example, whom I referred to earlier, rejected Hindu systems of philosophy as no philosophy at all. Phaedrus seemed to assimilate them, or be assimilated by them. There was no feeling of contradiction. Eventually, I came to Poincaré. Here again there was little duplication, but another kind of phenomenon. Phaedrus follows a long and tortuous path into the highest abstractions, seems about to come down, and then stops. Poincaré starts with the most basic scientific verities, works up to the same abstractions, and then stops. Both trails stop right at each other's end. There is perfect continuity between them. When you live in the shadow of insanity, the appearance of another mind that thinks and talks as yours does is something close to a blessed event. Like Robinson Crusoe's discovery of footprints on the sand. Poincaré lived from 1854 to 1912, a professor at the University of Paris. His beard and pince-nez were reminiscent of Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, who lived in Paris at the same time and was only 10 years younger. During Poincaré's lifetime, an alarmingly deep crisis in the foundations of the exact sciences had begun. For years, scientific truth had been beyond the possibility of a doubt. The logic of science was infallible. And if the scientists were sometimes mistaken, this was assumed to be only from their mistaking its rules. The great questions had all been answered. The mission of science was now simply to refine these answers to greater and greater accuracy. True, there were still unexplained phenomena such as radioactivity, transmission of light through the ether, and the peculiar relationship of magnetic to electric forces. But these, if past trends were any indication, had eventually to fall. It was hardly guessed by anyone that within a few decades there would be no more absolute space, absolute time, absolute substance, or even absolute magnitude. That classical physics, the scientific rock of ages, would become approximate. That the soberest and most respected of astronomers would be telling mankind that if it looked long enough through a telescope powerful enough, what it would see was the back of its own head. The basis of the foundation-shattering theory of relativity was as yet understood only by very few, of whom Poincaré, as the most eminent mathematician of his time, was one. In his Foundations of Science, Poincaré explained that the antecedents of the crisis in the foundations of science were very old. It had long been sought in vain, he said, to demonstrate the axiom known as Euclid's fifth postulate, and this search was the start of the crisis. Euclid's postulate of parallels, which states that through a given point there's not more than one parallel line to a given straight line, we usually learn in 10th grade geometry. It is one of the basic building blocks out of which the entire mathematics of geometry is constructed. All the other axioms seemed so obvious as to be unquestionable, but this one did not. Yet you couldn't get rid of it without destroying huge portions of the mathematics, and no one seemed able to reduce it to anything more elementary. What vast effort had been wasted in this chimeric hope was truly unimaginable, Poincaré said. Finally, in the first quarter of the 19th century, and almost at the same time, a Hungarian and a Russian, Bolyai and Lobachevsky, established irrefutably that a proof of Euclid's fifth postulate is impossible. They did this by reasoning that if there were any way to reduce Euclid's postulate to other, surer axioms, another effect would also be noticeable. A reversal of Euclid's postulate would create logical contradictions in the geometry. So, they reversed Euclid's postulate. Lobachevsky assumes at the start that through a given point can be drawn two parallels to a given straight, and he retains besides all Euclid's other axioms. From these hypotheses, he deduces a series of theorems among which it's impossible to find any contradiction, and he constructs a geometry whose faultless logic is inferior in nothing to that of the Euclidean geometry. Thus, by his failure to find any contradictions, he proves that the fifth postulate is irreducible to simpler axioms. It wasn't the proof that was alarming. It was its rational byproduct that soon overshadowed it, and almost everything else in the field of mathematics. Mathematics, the cornerstone of scientific certainty, was suddenly uncertain. We now had two contradictory visions of unshakable scientific truth, true for all men of all ages, regardless of their individual preferences. This was the basis of the profound crisis that shattered the scientific complacency of the Gilded Age. How do we know which one of these geometries is right? If there is no basis for distinguishing between them, then you have a total mathematics which admits logical contradictions. But a mathematics that admits internal logical contradictions is no mathematics at all. The ultimate effect of the non-Euclidean geometries becomes nothing more than a magician's mumbo-jumbo in which belief is sustained purely by faith. And of course, once that door was opened, one could hardly expect the number of contradictory systems of unshakable scientific truth to be limited to two. A German named Riemann appeared with another unshakable system of geometry, which throws overboard not only Euclid's postulate, but also the first axiom, which states that only one straight line can pass through two points. Again, there is no internal contradiction, only an inconsistency with both Lobachevskian and Euclidean geometries. According to the theory of relativity, Riemann geometry best describes the world we live in. At Three Forks, the road cuts into a narrow canyon of whitish-tan rock, past some Lewis and Clark caves. East of Butte, we go up a long, hard grade, cross the Continental Divide, then go down into a valley. Later we pass the great stack of the Anaconda Smelter, turn into the town of Anaconda, and find a good restaurant with steak and coffee. We go up a long grade that leads to a lake surrounded by pine forests, and past some fishermen who push a small boat into the water. Then the road winds down again through the pine forest, and I see by the angle of the sun that the morning is almost ended. We pass through Phillipsburg and are off into Valley Meadows. The headwind becomes more gusty here, so I slow down to 55 to lessen it a little. We go through Maxville, and by the time we reach Hall, are badly in need of a rest. We find a churchyard by the side of the road and stop. The wind is blowing hard now and is chilly, but the sun is warm, and we lay out on our jackets and helmets on the grass on the leeward side of the church for a rest. It's very lonely and open up here, but beautiful. When you have mountains in the distance, or even hills, you have space. Chris turns his face into his jacket and tries to sleep. Everything is so different now without the Sutherlands. So lonely. If you'll excuse me, I'll just talk Chautauqua now, until the loneliness goes away. To solve the problem of what is mathematical truth, Poincaré said, we should first ask ourselves, what is the nature of geometric axioms? Are they synthetic a priori judgments, as Kant said? That is, do they exist as a fixed part of man's consciousness, independently of experience and uncreated by experience? Poincaré thought not. They would then impose themselves upon us with such force that we couldn't conceive the contrary proposition, or build upon it a theoretic edifice. There would be no non-Euclidean geometry. Should we therefore conclude that the axioms of geometry are experimental verities? Poincaré didn't think that was so either. If they were, they would be subject to continual change and revision as new laboratory data came in. This seemed to be contrary to the whole nature of geometry itself. Poincaré concluded that the axioms of geometry are conventions. Our choice among all possible conventions is guided by experimental facts, but it remains free and is limited only by the necessity of avoiding all contradiction. Thus it is that the postulates can remain rigorously true, even though the experimental laws that have determined their adoption are only approximative. The axioms of geometry, in other words, are merely disguised definitions. Then, having identified the nature of geometric axioms, he turned to the question, is Euclidean geometry true, or is Riemann geometry true? He answered, the question has no meaning. As well ask whether the metric system is true and the avoirdupois system is false. Whether Cartesian coordinates are true and polar coordinates are false. One geometry cannot be more true than another. It can only be more convenient. Geometry is not true, it is advantageous. Poincaré then went on to demonstrate the conventional nature of other concepts of science, such as space and time, showing that there isn't one way of measuring these entities that is more true than another. That which is generally adopted is only more convenient. Our concepts of space and time are also definitions, selected on the basis of their convenience in handling the facts. This radical understanding of our most basic scientific concepts is not yet complete, however. The mystery of what is space and time may be made more understandable by this explanation, but now the burden of sustaining the order of the universe rests on facts. What are facts? Poincaré proceeded to examine these critically. Which facts are you going to observe? He asked. There is an infinity of them. There is no more chance that an unselective observation of facts will produce science than there is that a monkey at a typewriter will produce the Lord's Prayer. The same is true of hypotheses. Poincaré wrote, if a phenomenon admits of a complete mechanical explanation, it will admit of an infinity of others which will account equally well for all the peculiarities disclosed by experiment. This was the statement made by Phaedrus in the laboratory. It raised the question that failed him out of school. If the scientist had at his disposal infinite time, Poincaré said, it would only be necessary to say to him, look and notice well. But as there isn't time to see everything, and as it's better not to see than to see wrongly, it's necessary for him to make a choice. Poincaré laid down some rules. There is a hierarchy of facts. The more general a fact, the more precious it is. Those which serve many times are better than those which have little chance of coming up again. Biologists, for example, would be at a loss to construct a science if only individuals and no species existed, and if heredity didn't make children like parents. Which facts are likely to reappear? The simple facts. How to recognize them? Choose those that seem simple. Either this simplicity is real, or the complex elements are indistinguishable. In the first case, we're likely to meet this simple fact again, either alone or as an element in a complex fact. The second case, too, has a good chance of recurring, since nature doesn't randomly construct such cases. Where is the simple fact? Scientists have been seeking it in the two extremes, in the infinitely great and in the infinitely small. Biologists, for example, have been instinctively led to regard the cell as more interesting than the whole animal. And since Poincaré's time, the protein molecule is more interesting than the cell. The outcome has shown the wisdom of this, since cells and molecules belonging to different organisms have been found to be more alike than the organisms themselves. How then choose the interesting fact, the one that begins again and again? Method is precisely this choice of facts. It is needful then to be occupied first with creating a method, and many have been imagined, since none imposes itself. It's proper to begin with the regular facts, but after a rule is established beyond all doubt, the facts in conformity with it become dull because they no longer teach us anything new. Then it's the exception that becomes important. We seek not resemblances, but differences. Choose the most accentuated differences because they're the most striking and also the most instructive. We first seek the cases in which this rule has the greatest chance of failing. By going very far away in space or very far away in time, we may find our usual rules entirely overturned, and these grand overturnings enable us the better to see the little changes that may happen nearer to us. But what we ought to aim at is less the ascertainment of resemblances and differences than the recognition of likenesses hidden under apparent divergences. Particular rules seem at first discordant, but looking more closely we see in general that they resemble each other. Different as to matter, they are alike as to form, or to the order of their parts. When we look at them with this bias, we shall see them enlarge and tend to embrace everything. And this it is that makes the value of certain facts that come to complete an assemblage and to show that it is the faithful image of other known assemblages. No, Poincaré concluded, a scientist does not choose at random the facts he observes. He seeks to condense much experience and much thought into a slender volume. And that's why a little book on physics contains so many past experiences and 1,000 times as many possible experiences whose result is known beforehand. Then Poincaré illustrated how a fact is discovered. He had described generally how scientists arrive at facts and theories, but now he penetrated narrowly into his own personal experience with the mathematical functions that established his early fame. For 15 days, he said, he strove to prove that there couldn't be any such functions. Every day he seated himself at his work table, stayed an hour or two, tried a great number of combinations, and reached no results. Then one evening, contrary to his custom, he drank black coffee and couldn't sleep. Ideas arose in crowds. He felt them collide until pairs interlocked, so to speak, making a stable combination. The next morning, he had only to write out the results. A wave of crystallization had taken place. He described how a second wave of crystallization, guided by analogies to established mathematics, produced what he later named the Theta-Fuchsian series. He left Caen, where he was living, to go on a geologic excursion. The changes of travel made him forget mathematics. He was about to enter a bus, and at the moment when he put his foot on the step, the idea came to him, without anything in his former thoughts having paved the way for it, that the transformations he had used to define the Fuchsian functions were identical with those of non-Euclidean geometry. He didn't verify the idea, he said. He just went on with a conversation on the bus. But he felt a perfect certainty. Later he verified the result at his leisure. A later discovery occurred while he was walking by a seaside bluff. It came to him with just the same characteristics of brevity, suddenness, and immediate certainty. Another major discovery occurred while he was walking down a street. Others eulogized this process as the mysterious workings of genius. But Poincaré was not content with such a shallow explanation. He tried to fathom more deeply what had happened. Mathematics, he said, isn't merely a question of applying rules any more than science. It doesn't merely make the most combinations possible according to certain fixed laws. The combinations so obtained would be exceedingly numerous, useless, and cumbersome. The true work of the inventor consists in choosing among these combinations so as to eliminate the useless ones, or rather, to avoid the trouble of making them. And the rules that must guide the choice are extremely fine and delicate. It's almost impossible to state them precisely. They must be felt rather than formulated. Poincaré then hypothesized that this selection is made by what he called the subliminal self, an entity that corresponds exactly with what Phaedrus called pre-intellectual awareness. The subliminal self, Poincaré said, looks at a large number of solutions to a problem, but only the interesting ones break into the domain of consciousness. Mathematical solutions are selected by the subliminal self on the basis of mathematical beauty, of the harmony of numbers and forms, of geometric elegance. This is a true aesthetic feeling which all mathematicians know, Poincaré said, but of which the profane are so ignorant as often to be tempted to smile. But it is this harmony, this beauty, that is at the center of it all. Poincaré made it clear that he was not speaking of romantic beauty, the beauty of appearances which strikes the senses. He meant classic beauty, which comes from the harmonious order of the parts, and which a pure intelligence can grasp, which gives structure to romantic beauty, and without which life would be only vague and fleeting. A dream from which one could not distinguish one's dreams because there would be no basis for making the distinction. It is the quest of this special classic beauty, the sense of harmony of the cosmos, which makes us choose the facts most fitting to contribute to this harmony. It is not the facts, but the relation of things that results in the universal harmony that is the sole objective reality. What guarantees the objectivity of the world in which we live is that this world is common to us with other thinking beings. Through the communications that we have with other men, we receive from them ready-made harmonious reasonings. We know that these reasonings do not come from us, and at the same time we recognize in them, because of their harmony, the work of reasonable beings like ourselves. And as these reasonings appear to fit the world of our sensations, we think we may infer that these reasonable beings have seen the same thing as we. Thus it is that we know we haven't been dreaming. It is this harmony, this quality, if you will, that is the sole basis for the only reality we can ever know. Poincaré's contemporaries refused to acknowledge that facts are pre-selected because they thought that to do so would destroy the validity of scientific method. They presumed that pre-selected facts meant that truth is whatever you like, and called his ideas conventionalism. They vigorously ignored the truth that their own principle of objectivity is not itself an observable fact, and therefore, by their own criteria, should be put in a state of suspended animation. They felt they had to do this because if they didn't, the entire philosophic underpinning of science would collapse. Poincaré didn't offer any resolutions of this quandary. He didn't go far enough into the metaphysical implications of what he was saying to arrive at the solution. What he neglected to say was that the selection of facts before you observe them is whatever you like, only in a dualistic subject-object metaphysical system. When quality enters the picture as a third metaphysical entity, the preselection of facts is no longer arbitrary. The preselection of facts is not based on subjective, capricious, whatever you like, but on quality, which is reality itself. Thus the quandary vanishes. It was as though Phaedrus had been working on a puzzle of his own, and because of lack of time, had left one whole side unfinished. Poincaré had been working on a puzzle of his own. His judgment that the scientist selects facts, hypotheses, and axioms on the basis of harmony also left the rough, serrated edge of a puzzle incomplete. To leave the impression in the scientific world that the source of all scientific reality is merely a subjective, capricious harmony is to solve problems of epistemology while leaving an unfinished edge at the border of metaphysics that makes the epistemology unacceptable. But we know from Phaedrus's metaphysics that the harmony Poincaré talked about is not subjective. It is the source of subjects and objects, and exists in an anterior relationship to them. It is not capricious. It is the force that opposes capriciousness, the ordering principle of all scientific and mathematical thought which destroys capriciousness, and without which no scientific thought can proceed. What brought tears of recognition to my eyes was the discovery that these unfinished air of thought, capable of uniting the separate languages of science and art into one. On either side of us, the mountains have become steep to form a long, narrow valley that winds into Missoula. This headwind has worn me down, and I'm tired now. Chris taps me and points to a high hill with a large painted M on it. I nod. This morning we passed one like it as we left Bozeman. A fragment occurs to me that the freshmen in each school go up there and paint the M each year. At a station where we fill with gas, a man with a trailer carrying two Appaloosa horses strikes up a conversation. Most horse people are anti-motorcycle, it seems, but this one is not, and he asks a lot of questions, which I answer. Chris keeps asking to go up to the M, but I can see from here it's a steep, rutty scrambler road. With our highway machine and heavy load, I don't want to fool with it. We stretch our legs for a while, walk around, and then somewhat wearily head out of Missoula toward Lolo Pass. A recollection appears that not many years ago this road was all dirt with twists and turns around every rock and fold in the mountains. Now it's paved and the turns are very broad. All the traffic we were in has evidently headed north for Kalispell or Coeur d'Alene, for there's hardly any now. We're headed southwest, have picked up a tailwind, and we feel better because of it. The road starts to wind up into the pass. All traces of the east are gone now, at least in my imagination. All the rain here comes from Pacific winds, and all the rivers and streams here return it to the Pacific. We should be at the ocean in 2 or 3 days. At Lolo Pass, we see a restaurant and pull up in front of it beside an old Harley Highmiler. It has a homemade pannier on the back and 36,000 on the odometer. A real cross-country man. Inside, we fill up on pizza and milk, and when finished, leave right away. There's not much sunlight left, and a search for a campsite after dark is difficult and unpleasant. As we leave, we see the cross-country man by the cycles with his wife, and we say hello. He is from Missouri, and the relaxed look on his wife's face tells me they've been having a good trip. The man asks, "Were you bucking that wind up to Missoula, too?" I nod. "It must have been 30 or 40 miles an hour. At least," he says. We talk about camping for a while, and then comment on how cold it is. They never dreamed in Missouri it would be this cold in the summer, even in the mountains. They've had to buy clothes and blankets. "It shouldn't be too cold tonight," I say. "We're only at about 5,000 feet. Chris says, "We're going to camp just down the road." "At one of the campsites?" "No, just somewhere off the road," I say. They show no inclination of wanting to join us, so after a pause, I press the starter button and we wave off. On the road, the shadows of the mountain trees are long now. After 5 or 10 miles, we see some logging road turnoffs and head up. The logging road is sandy, so I keep in low gear, with feet out to prevent a spill. We see side roads off the main logging road, but I stay on the main one until after about a mile we come to some bulldozers. That means they're still logging here. We turn back and head up one of the side roads. After about half a mile, we come to a tree fallen across the road. That's good. That means this road has been abandoned. I say, "This is it," to Chris, and he gets off. We're on a slope that allows us to see over unbroken forest for miles. Chris is all for exploring, but I'm so tired I just want to rest. "You go by yourself," I say. "No, you come along." "I'm really tired, Chris. In the morning we'll explore." I untie the packs and spread the sleeping bags out on the ground. Chris goes off. I stretch out, and the tiredness fills my arms and legs. Silent, beautiful forest. In time, Chris returns and says he has diarrhea. "Oh," I say, and get up. "Do you have to change underwear?"
"Yes."
He looks sheepish. Well, they're in the pack by the front of the cycle. Change and get a bar of soap from the saddlebag, and we'll go down to the stream and wash the old underwear out. He's embarrassed by the whole thing, and now is glad to take orders. The downward slope of the road makes our feet flop as we head toward the stream. Chris shows me some stones he's collected while I've been sleeping. The pine smell of the forest is rich here. It's turning cool, and the sun is very low. The silence and the fatigue and the sinking of the sun depress me a little, but I keep it to myself. After Chris has washed out his underwear and has it completely clean and wrung out, we head back up the logging road. As we climb it, I get a sudden depressed feeling I've been walking up this logging road all my life. "Dad?"
"What?"
A small bird rises from a tree in front of us.
"What should I be when I grow up?"
The bird disappears over a far ridge. I don't know what to say.
"Honest,"
I finally say.
"I mean, what kind of job?"
"Any kind."
"Why do you get mad when I ask that?"
"I'm not mad. I just think, I don't know. I'm just too tired to think. It doesn't matter what you do." Roads like this one get smaller and smaller and then quit. Later I notice he's not keeping up. The sun is below the horizon now, and twilight is on us. We walk separately back up the logging road, and when we reach the cycle, we climb into the sleeping bags and, without a word, go to sleep.